It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold, filling in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll preview the situation surrounding the Syrian peace talks slated to begin in Geneva late this week.
First, our next guest has been tracking income inequality in the United States. He co-authored a study about the topic that was just released. Timothy Smeeting is with us. He's Distinguished Professor of Public Affairs and Economics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and Director of the Institute for Research on Poverty. Tim, welcome to the show.
Welcome. Hi. Thank you.
All of the above.
All of the above.
It's good to have you here. Well, your report is part of a report card on income inequity and inequality. What grade would the U.S. get based on what you found?
It depends how you look at it. I would say that if you think we have too much inequality, and that it's going to get worse, you'd agree with me. You'd give it an A. If you thought income inequality was just fine and it wasn't something we'd worry about, then you'd give me a failing grade.
So you're saying income inequality is going to get worse. That's the bottom line.
It's obvious that it is. The recovery is very weak at the bottom and in terms of jobs. Millions of people looking for work who can't find it. The jobs we are creating are mainly service sector jobs, which are low paying and which are near the bottom of the wage distribution. That's not enough to support a family. The middle class is in trouble. They haven't had a wage increase in a long time. But what's the good news is at the top of the distribution, where capital markets are booming, where corporate profits are large, and this is boosting the incomes of the well-to-do, those who can afford to invest in capital markets. It's helping people's 401ks, too, so there's some effect. There's also a high education premium now, and the job recovery is much faster and stronger and better at the top of the distribution, and it will continue to be so. So what we got is a situation where the bottom is holding, the middle is sinking, and the top is rising. And we've never quite had a situation like that in America before, at least not for 100 years.
Why do you think it is that the income distribution after the recovery isn't more evenly distributed? Why is it siphoning right up to the top?
Well, the labor market's changing. There's a big structural change in the labor markets. You can't walk out of a high school and into a middle-class job now. Manufacturing employment has declined for 30 years, and it's declining again. It's not going to come back to be where it was. Construction jobs are hard to find. And most jobs that are repetitive in the middle of the distribution that used to pay a wage high enough to live on are being replaced, some by robotics, others are being exported, and so forth. So there's pressure in the middle. If you're 30 years of age and you've only got a high school degree, you're in trouble in this economy. We need to train and educate people so that when demand finally does pick up, we hope in over the next few years, that you'll be able to get a better-paying job at a profession that will support a middle-class lifestyle. So that's the situation right now, and it's not good.
Now, we've talked about how the post-recession economy is looking pretty rosy for the upper echelons, not so great for the people at the bottom. Now, is this the same pattern as we saw before the recession, or is there something about the recession that has skewered it even more so in this direction?
Well, before the recession, things were pretty flat in labor markets. People borrowed a lot, spent a lot. We told a lot of people to buy homes, and they did, at the very top of the market, unfortunately. And then in the Great Recession, it all fell apart. Now, as we restructure our economy and as we recover, the economy is changing. The demand for skilled labor is high. The demand for low-skilled labor is low, although we are creating a lot of part-time service sector jobs that pay near the minimum wage. We've got a good safety net for people at the bottom. The food stamps or SNAP program, food share it's called in Wisconsin, and the earned income tax credit helps support families with children who can't earn enough to keep their family from being poor. But in the middle of the distribution, it's really hard. Some people are going back to work at jobs they used to have at pay that's less than they had before. Others are having a spouse who's or a partner who's lost a job, and therefore their incomes are cut. These aren't poor people, but there are people who have to live with diminished expectations. They live in a world where they see people around them losing their jobs or not getting ahead much in the labor market. They realize that their home is not worth what it used to be. The price for college and other services, health care, is going up, and they feel squeezed and helpless. And then they turn around and you watch TV or read anything, and you see the people at the top carrying on just well, very well. People, many of them, I'm not saying they don't deserve it. They took chances. They were entrepreneurs. They did well. But all the rewards are going there. And that's not a good recipe for a democracy. It's not a good recipe for equal opportunity, because the children of the well-to-do have many more chances now than the children of the middle class. And Americans care a lot more about equality of opportunity than equality of outcome. And if you sense that my kid's not going to have a chance to be a Bill Gates or a Sergey Brin or whatever, you're going to be discouraged. And I think that's unfortunately where we are now.
Now, we've got some indications that people are unhappy with some of the way income is distributed. There was a Gallup poll that was just out yesterday. People were asked how satisfied they were with the way income and wealth are distributed in the U.S. 67% of respondents said they were dissatisfied, and 39% described themselves as very dissatisfied. And apparently, this is cutting across partisan lines. Can you talk about a little bit about the way people are processing the new economic landscape?
Well, here we are. The recession was declared over in the summer of 2009. That's 4.5 years later. And people are asking the question that Ronald Reagan asked them in 1980. Are you any better off now than you were before? And the answer is no, I'm not. And does it look like things are going to get better? No, it doesn't. But at the same time, they look at what goes on in the finance industry. They realize that they read the paper about what doctors and lawyers are paid. They see that if robotics are replacing jobs, they ask who owns the robots. It's not me. It's two different Americas, and it's easy to be dissatisfied. Now, if income were rising everywhere, if the bottom end was even getting a little bit better off or the middle was getting better off, we'd feel a little bit differently. Well, you know, I'm a little bit better off than I was last year, and okay, so those guys at the top are a lot better off, but I'm better off. But that's the issue this time. That's what's different. This time, the middle class is feeling like they lost out in the recession. And in fact, median income is now 7% below where it was the pre-recession peak, and things look pretty flat. The job market looks pretty flat. Incomes look flat. Wages look flat. And so what's there to be excited about if you were a former middle class or someone in the middle class is trying to hold on? And then you realize that a lot of these other guys are doing really well. And what sticks in people's craws is that I work hard. I did the right thing. I'm trying to do everything I can. I go to work every day. I put in good time for my employer, and I just can't get better off. I'm worse off now than I was, and I don't see any great prospects for things getting better in the future. That's scary. That's not very American.
Now, is this kind of inequality inherently a bad thing? I mean, you mentioned the Reagan era, the era of trickle-down economics. Mm-hmm. Can a similar case be made here that what's good for the top of us will trickle down and the prosperity will eventually reach everybody?
Well, it hasn't trickled down yet. I'll say that. And unfortunately, where in the past, quite often, it did trickle down, or a little bit trickle down, it's just not trickling at all now. To the extent to which capital is replacing labor in the workplace, those jobs are never going to come back. For a small number of people who can operate sophisticated machinery, who have good math and other skills, who have engineering degrees, who are mobile, who can work in the high-end service sector, they've got a bright future. So most of this audience we have is in Madison, and I'm talking about the Epic crowd, for instance. Our biggest private employer, growing like Topsy, providing a really important service to the healthcare sector, helping digitize their records. But if you don't have a college degree or even a master's degree, you're probably not going to get a job there.
We're talking right now to UW economist Timothy Smeeting about a new report he co-authored on income inequality in the United States. That report is part of a national report card on the economy from the Stanford Center on Poverty and Inequality.
You can join in with your questions and your thoughts about income inequality. Why do you think inequality has been on the rise in the United States? Have you experienced that yourself? We'd like to hear from you. 1-800-642-1234 or email at talk@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation after a look at the latest news with Kristen Durst. We continue our conversation now with Timothy Smeeting. He's co-author of a new report on income inequality in the United States.
And you can join in the conversation right now. What do you think about rising inequality? If you had to answer that Gallup poll question that we talked about from yesterday, how satisfied are you with the way income and wealth are distributed in the United States? What would you say to that? And what do you think the causes and the solutions might be? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Tim, we were talking about college degrees. Is part of the problem here that we still live in a country that believes people need college degrees to have a decent middle class life? Do we need to change the way we think about jobs and the way you can get them?
Well, Veronica, we've not been doing well at graduating people from universities. They've been starting and getting into debt, but not finishing. This isn't a problem at a place like University of Wisconsin-Madison, but it is a problem in the other branch campuses in the UW system, for instance, where first-time college goers go, they take on some debt, then they, for economic reasons or other reasons, they end up postponing or putting off some classes. And they end up in a situation where they've incurred debt and they can't pay it back. And the reason they can't pay it back is because there's not a very good job at the other end of the line. And this is a sad situation. Now, quite often, the answer is to move to a place where there are jobs. There are booming big cities, Chicago, Boston, Pittsburgh, and so forth. But you have to be able to afford to go there and look and find a job. And probably spend some time interning.
And does it also mean that maybe we just should let go of our notion that people should go to college?
No, I don't think so. That's wrong. What's happening is that the labor market is so slack that people who have jobs that don't really require college education can hire people with college educations because they can't find jobs elsewhere. Not everybody needs to get a four-year degree. But everyone needs something beyond a bachelor's degree. You have to have a profession or a trade. You have to be able to think and work on your own. You have to be able to network, read, write, be self-managing, and so forth. And those are skills that normally a high school student alone doesn't have. So you need something, either a technical school or a four-year degree.
I want to go to the phones right now. I've got a lot of folks waiting to talk to you. We'll start off with Jim in Rice Lake. Hey, Jim.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. A couple of points I'd like to make. I am not in favor of a lot of people who seem to be in favor of wealth distribution. I think there's a sentiment in this country that we penalize for people for success, and a lot of that trickles down to smaller business owners who are the top employers of America, and we cannot penalize people by letting the government come in and overregulate and overtax businesses, because that is destroying our economy. The other thing, though, is I feel that we're a lot like the Roman Empire, where the middle class is supporting everyone, and these social programs, there are a lot of people. I mean, when you have more people going on disability than you have going out and getting jobs or extending unemployment benefits beyond a year, there's something wrong with that, and we just cannot continue to afford to support everyone. Thank you.
So, Jim, let me ask you, if you're still there, what do you propose if you're – looks like we lost Jim. Well, let's go to you, Tim. What do you think about that? Jim does not want wealth redistribution.
Well, I'm trying to understand Jim some, but the idea is the gains. What happens in this economy is that there are winners and losers, and the winners are winning big and the losers are losing more than they usually do. And in my mind, can the winners compensate the losers somehow? I don't want to penalize people for their success, but our tax rates are very light on people at the top. We allow you to declare your income as a capital gain and pay a 20% tax rate or as carried interest if you're in the financial services, and pay a 15% tax rate, which is less than most people's lowest paid employees do. Disability is an important issue. The problem, though, is jobs. And quite often, older workers who have been laid off of career jobs have some injuries and can't find good work and end up on disability insurance. Now, if we could find work for them, that would be fine. We want to extend unemployment insurance only for people who are very long-term unemployed. The other thing we could do, Jim, or whoever else out there, is make them an offer of a job of last resort. Part of the problem is a lot of people say the poor don't work enough, or this guy could work, how come he's not making it on his own? And the guy says, I can't find a job. Or the girl says, I can't find a job. Well, fine, provide him with a job of last resort. Go out and find a job in Rice Lake or anywhere else in the state that pays 10 or 11 bucks an hour, and give them a shot at that job. So we have to create jobs at the same time we're shaking a stick at unfortunate people and saying, you know, you're the disease, not the cure. You need to go out there and work. Well, give them a job. Get your local industry council together. Get your local small business employers to say what it is exactly that they need, what sorts of workers with what skills, and then spread that word around the local high schools and the community colleges and guarantee a job to somebody who comes out and who can do those things.
You know, Jim also mentioned that he thought we looked like the Roman Empire, which makes me curious. Have we seen cycles like this before where wealth is concentrated in the top?
Not since the 1880s or 1890s, and then things changed. So this is like 120, 130 years ago. Our wealth concentration is up to where it was before, just before the Great Depression. And at that point, everything collapsed and everything was wiped out. And that was a painful experience we don't want to go through. The Great Recession is the second worst episode like that, except for the fact that capital markets have come back very strong. The stock market's doubled since it's been at the bottom. People who've had the ability to save, have 401ks or own stocks and bonds, are doing very well right now. And I don't think they're being overtaxed. I think they're being undertaxed.
I want to get in another call, so let's go now to Dan in Wausau. Hi, Dan.
Hello.
What do you think about this?
Well, after watching the news, I never really was into politics personally, but I took an interest in it after watching things decline back in early 2000 with the onset of the war. I noticed personally that corporate loopholes, corporate personhood, and these ways that larger corporations skirt around the law is exactly what I think has led to this. Corporations just have more power than normal citizens do. And, you know, they have the power to get rid of the 40-hour work week. Labor laws people have fought for a long time for are just being disintegrated right now. I work for a rather large company, and I'm experiencing the same thing. In the golden days, maybe, you know, 10 years ago, people got bonuses. People had retirement pensions. And now retirement, it's laughable. It's a thing of the past. There's just no way anybody my age, 39 or younger, is going to have very much of a future.
All right. Thank you so much for calling, Dan. Appreciate that. And Tim, what do you think? How much do corporate regulations and practices have to do with the income inequality we're seeing right now?
Well, it's hard. If Jim were on there and he and Dan had a debate, Jim would say, oh, the government's all over us, we're overregulated. And Dan would say, wait a minute, you guys are getting away with murder. And the truth is obviously somewhere in between, but it's very clear who the winners are now. And the large corporations and manufacturers are winners. They have much bigger worldwide markets. Labor is very weak. I got into a couple of debates with small employers in the, actually near Rice Lake, who had a great job for welders with 5 years experience at least for 10 bucks an hour. Wait a minute, 10 bucks an hour, 5 years experience, high quality welder? No, we can't find him. Well, raise your wages for Pete's sakes. Offer him more money. That's the answer. So I'm, there's truth to both things here. Now, another thing for Jim is that small businesses start up a lot, but they also die a lot very quickly. Large corporations should pay their way, but quite often, especially those who have many subsidiaries abroad or in other countries, can manipulate their income. There's a whole branch of accounting at Northeastern University in Pennsylvania that's called funds transfer. And the whole idea is to move the revenues to the country or state or locality which has the lowest tax rates so that you can minimize taxes. And it's going to be a long time before we can get that together. And labor has become very weak. We don't have a voice for labor in this country. And I'm not talking about just about unionization. I mean, in other places, there are labor parties and, you know, people are paid some sort of guaranteed wage.
And, Tim, we're going to have to leave it there, but I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Veronica and Mike. It's been nice talking. We could go on, but everyone knows where to find me on my email address.
All right. Thank you, Timothy, UW-Madison economist and director of UW's Institute for Research on Poverty. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold in for Rob Ferret today. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Tomorrow, the United Nations will begin talks in Switzerland aimed at ending the conflict in Syria. Analysts see these talks as the biggest diplomatic push yet to end the war, which has been going on for 3 years.
There was also a report released today showing evidence of war crimes in Syria. The report comes from former war crimes prosecutors and is based on pictures snuck out of Syria.
Here to give us a preview of the upcoming peace talks in Switzerland is Besma Momani. She's an associate professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Waterloo in Canada. She's also a senior fellow at the Center for International Governance and Innovation and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Besma, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So the United Nations is hosting peace talks in Switzerland starting tomorrow. Who do we expect to take part?
Well, it's a very large, actually, meeting. In fact, one wonders if there's any hotel rooms after that and the Davos meetings in Switzerland. Many countries who are part of this include the Gulf countries like Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and others. The regime, the Assad regime, is sending a delegation. The Syrian National Coalition is sending a delegation representing the opposition. The Americans, obviously, many of the European countries. Interestingly, is who's not there. In this case, Iran is not there. Many of the more radical fighters like ISIS, the Islamic State of Syria, which is a offshoot of Al-Qaeda, will not be there. Islamic Front, also another rebel movement, will not be there. Obviously, I think there are many people who have a lot of concerns about whether or not there's an agreement to be done if many of those fighters and those benefactors like Iran are not actually at the table.
Well, let's take a step back for a moment. As we said, the war has been going on for about 3 years now. And let's get a sense of what was behind the war in Syria initially and what started the conflict to where we are now.
You know, I think what I hope your audience realizes, this really was a revolution. It was a revolution of people who, in fact, were motivated to come out after seeing actually horrific image to what we're hearing about today, as your previous segment noted, which was this horrific image of a child, a 13-year-old named Hamza, who was brutally, basically tortured by the Syrian regime, cigarette butts out on his body. He was castrated. He was bloodied and bruised, and this 13-year-old boy was returned to his family dead and basically told, you know, have another child, forget this one, because in fact he was out at a protest with his classmates and others for, you know, a regime change. And so this really propelled this revolution to move beyond the little town called Daraa to basically becoming a national revolution. And I think that's something that people need to remember. And unfortunately, it has taken on a sectarian tone, but it really was about people saying that no, you know, no government has a right to torture children.
Well, that brings us up to today. Yesterday, former war crimes prosecutors released a report showing evidence of war crimes in Syria in the form of mutilated corpses. Tell us where that report came from and what impact it may be having.
So this was a photographer who worked for the Syrian military that, in fact, was eventually a defector, but collected 55,000 images, tortured bodies, mutilated bodies, some to starvation. 11,000 individuals are assumed to be a part of that. And these are unfortunately realities that so many Syrians know today. You know, there are stories percolating, whether it's online, social media, and just frankly people who know our family members who have been through this, hear of these horrific stories of torture at the hands of the regime. It's not a surprise to many Syrians. I think what's a surprise here, or what's actually perhaps a good thing for those who want to see retribution, is the fact that all this data was being collated. And I think the impact of this hopefully might be, you know, to really bring some of those countries that continue to support the Assad regime to, in fact, double think about what their support is actually paying for, and that's the systematic, horrific violation of human rights across the country.
Now, some within the Assad regime have seen the pictures and said, how do we even know they're from Syria? They could have been taken outside the country. Where, show us documentation. What kind of response has that gotten?
You know, I think one of the things that is really fascinating about this conflict, it's one of the few that have been done in real time where we have information communication technology out there, not just the pictures that are being taken by this photographer, but there's tons of videos and a huge collection of data, of oral histories by individuals who are working effortlessly at the civil society level to indeed gather all this material so that one day when this conflict is over, some would pay for the crimes that are out there. So I believe that there is probably going to be a lot of sort of triangulation of all this data. Sorry for the academic tone there, but putting this all together, putting a story. You know, we have, for example, 130,000 individuals that have been killed. The Syrian Observatory of Human Rights, which keeps a tally, has a name for every single individual. There's an app for your phone where you can find out not only where they died, a video that links to it, you know, who exactly is the family member that claimed this, in this, you know, atrocity. All of that information is being collated at a really rapid pace. So I think there's a lot of data out there that people don't really know about. But indeed, I think the time will come when this will be all put together, and I think it'll be very condemning evidence.
Is what you just talked about, the technology that's involved in identifying the dead and the atrocities committed, is that part of the new face of war these days?
It really is. It's almost a 2.0 in some respect. You know, this is a war that's, you know, being fought online. I mean, there's a Syrian electronic army, as we've seen, as hackers who've gone on to basically undermine different kinds of Western outlets, whether it's AP and other sources. And I think that this is part of the new phase of war. This is a war that's being fought on YouTube. It's being, in some cases, funded because of YouTube, whether it's, you know, radical jihadists being able to get money from certain donors because they can, in fact, attribute this particular mission or this particular, you know, attack against a government force and then seek payments for it. So it's very much being fought. And I think all Syrians in the diaspora know all too well how much of the information is online. But I think the interesting part here will be putting it all together and triangulating it and using that photos that have come out to make condemning evidence against the regime.
So the peace talks are slated to begin tomorrow. What is the best case scenario for a peace accord?
Well, I think few people see some sort of political resolution. What some people are hoping for at the very minimum is some sort of humanitarian agreement to allow aid convoys to come into some of the besieged areas of Damascus. Some of these communities haven't seen food in 3 to 4 months. So there is starvation at a mass scale going on, particularly in the Palestinian refugee camp of Yarmouk, but also other areas such as Aleppo, where the fighting has continued to be at a stalemate, where government forces and rebels are fighting over street and then losing it to the next day. Part of the hope here is that there might actually be a ceasefire for Aleppo to, in fact, allow, in both cases, both parts, in fact, have an interest in redirecting troops because that's not going anywhere. That doesn't solve the fact that the eastern part of the country is completely under the hands of ISIS and Al-Qaeda affiliate, and the country is really descending into a terrible state of affairs.
What challenges do you think are the most daunting as we go into these talks?
You know, I think that people don't recognize there are 6 million internally displaced refugees. That's an enormous, enormous burden on everybody in the country. There are, you know, millions outside the country, and that's obviously deplorable as too. But 6 million inside, people are living in parks. People are living and eating off of whatever vegetation they can find, trees. Cats are being eaten, and this is, you know, a society that does not eat that kind of animal. Mm-hmm. But clearly, desperation and hunger is doing it. It's an enormous tragedy inside this country, and there's unfortunately, you know, 21 million people left in the country that Assad is really willing to kill and torture in order to achieve his political objectives.
And anything that we should be on the lookout for as the peace talks begin, anything that would signal a bellwether in how the talks are heading?
You know, I think I'm looking at Lavrov and the Russian representative to see whether or not they're continuing to stand by this regime. I know this evidence is going to be, presented to the Russians forcefully in an effort to really shake them at their core. This is a time when I think, with the Sochi Games and Putin really trying to put on this liberal face all of a sudden, maybe we might just see some sort of pressure on the Syrian government to, in fact, loosen up and to allow some of this humanitarian, openings. But, unfortunately, so many people like myself are just so pessimistic about the prospects of a peace treaty between these parties. And as we haven't had a chance to get into, but the situation on the ground is really not, unfortunately, conducive to peace at the moment.
If the talks fail, what then?
I think we're going to continue to see the enormous rate of refugees pouring outside the country, 2 million plus going in. Let's not forget neighboring countries like Jordan and Lebanon have taken on 20% of their population. It's enormous. 130,000 have been killed. 11,000 of those are children. We have 3 years of no education in some of these countries. Polio, which had been eradicated for, decades in this country, is making a reappearance. It's a calamity of regional proportions that nobody's thought of. It's not Syria about it imploding, it's Syria exploding. And so the region is at stake here. And I think that's putting many of these, countries to come to Geneva. But again, the dynamics inside the country, particularly the fractured opposition and an Assad regime that continues to get replenished by both Iran and the Russians, is not motivating anybody to really sign a peace treaty.
Besma, thank you so much for joining us and talking about this today.
Thank you.
That was Besma Mamani, Associate Professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Waterloo in Canada. She's also a Senior Fellow at the Center for International Governance and Innovation and a Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution.
Coming up, we normally hear from Noah Obshinsky about what's going on in the news in Wisconsin. We'll hear him talk about something else in just a minute. But first, Kristen Durst joins us now from the newsroom with a look at headlines. We are in the thick of soup season right now as the weather gets colder, but what soup without a crusty loaf of bread? I really don't know. Our next guest is a recent convert to No Need Bread. That's K-N-E-A-D, of course.
Noah Obshinsky joins us now. He's one of our in-house foodies here at Wisconsin Public Radio, along with his role as assistant news director. Noah, good to have you back.
It's good to be here.
So bread, it's kind of intimidating for those of us who love to eat bread but are frightened by cooking it with all the whole the kneading, the rising, the kneading, the punching down. What can you tell me about no-knead bread that's going to help people like me get over this love-hate relationship?
It's not intimidating. Let's start there. This is a non-intimidating bread, and that's one of the reasons why I want to sort of preach its merits from the mountaintop, so to speak. To talk about no-knead bread, let's get into our time machines a little bit and go back all the way to 2006. And that is when the New York Times did a story about a baker in New York City by the name of Jim Leahy. He's the owner and head baker at Sullivan Street Bakery in New York City. This article was about this no-knead bread recipe that he was talking about. And granted, I'm sure no-knead baking has been around, I don't know, for thousands of years, probably since bread was created in North Africa and that sort of thing. But really, it hit the culinary world by storm in 2006 when this article was written. And basically, people have taken this basic recipe and have just taken it to all kinds of different places. Dessert breads, savory breads, cheesy breads.
So why do you not have to knead it? That's the thing. I mean, do they have some sort of, I don't know, special ingredient or something that needs it for you?
Yeah, well, there are a few things. And just for our audience sake, we should talk – when we talk about kneading is one of those things that you do when you make a traditional bread at home or in the bakery. And what it really does is it develops the gluten. It allows all those gluten molecules to be in the right place at the right time.
And that doesn't matter whether you have yeast in it or whether it's a quick bread, right? You have to knead any kind of bread.
Well, I mean, in order for the bread to rise, you need the yeast to do its thing. And kneading is important to make sure that what you get at the end of all of this is a bread that has a wonderful crunchy, what we call, a crumb, which is sort of the meat of the bread, and also a wonderful crust, a really crisp crust. And so what water allows those molecules to do is to get in the right place. And unlike a traditional bread recipe, which, you know, can take a few hours to make with kneading, this recipe that was brought to the public by Jim Leahy actually relies not only on water, but also time. Most breads take a few hours to make. This bread takes something on the, 12 to 18 hours to actually rise, to ferment. So what Jim and other bakers, home bakers, have relied on is this time for the bread to get to a place where it's ready to bake.
And it's not the typical thing where you put it in a bowl and you cover it up with saran wrap or a towel or something. You need slightly different equipment to do this, right, as I understand it?
It's kind of, most dough that you need it's fairly easy to manipulate in your hand. And in fact, I mean, that's one of the joys of kneading bread. And I'm not dissing traditional kneading here. Kneading is great. There is something that's lost out by doing this recipe. It is very hands-on. But this dough, when you make it, is very wet. It's sort of, it's just very wet and very hard to work with. But you just have to realize, you have to trust that it's all that water that's in this recipe that makes such a wonderful bread. And so it's very hard to actually like put out there and roll or manipulate. You do have to do some manipulation. You do have to fold it into a bowl in order to bake it. But it has very little structure compared to other traditional kneading breads.
So you'd have to have a little bit of time to put the ingredients together. You stick it in your pot.
Ah, yes. So we've talked about the two keys to this recipe. A lot of water, which allows the gluten molecules to get where they need to be. We've talked about time, which lets the dough sort of really get to a great place before you bake it. And the pot.
The pot. Yeah, tell us about that.
So as opposed to just putting your bread on, say, in a breadstone in your oven or on a cookie sheet or something like that, which a lot of people do, this recipe from Jim Leahy relies on a enclosed container, something like a Dutch oven or Pyrex enamel, a Le Creuset, something like that, something with a top on it. And what you do with this recipe is you put it in the oven half an hour before you actually bake it. You take it out when it's smoking hot, and you put the dough in this enclosed container, and you bake it in an enclosed container. And what that does is it makes sure that there's enough moisture in that bread so that you get that wonderful crust that you would normally get at a commercial bakery, down the road. One of those things that's so hard for a home baker to get is that wonderful crispy, crunchy crust, that we all know and love with, something like a baguette, for instance. And, the home baker, we've been told to, brush it with water. You can take a spray bottle and spray it with water. You can paint egg yolks and a combination of egg yolks and water on it. And, you'll get a crust. But with this recipe, by baking it inside an enclosed space like a Dutch oven, you're ensuring that that moisture doesn't escape, and it actually creates that crisp, wonderful crust that you love from commercial bakeries.
So if you had somebody from France who's used to eating a baguette, would they be steamed if you handed them some of this bread or what?
Oh, well played, sir. Well, talking about steaming, though, one of the reasons why you have this wonderful bread...
I wasn't trying to joke because of the steaming, but still, go ahead.
Oh, well, yeah. I'm sorry. I thought you were
take credit for it, Mike.
Yeah, okay, I'll go with it. Yeah.
So if you ever wonder why...
Is it like a baguette?
Well, this is the thing. If you ever wonder why a bakery has such wonderful crust in their bread, one of the reasons is many of their ovens actually have steam injection. They're introducing steam in the baking process.
And that's how you get crust?
And that's how you get the crust that we all know and love.
I didn't know that.
So what we're doing... because we don't have, $5,000 ovens, is we're sort of recreating that in our homes with a Dutch oven.
That's cool. Now, is it just a big lump of bread when it comes out then, or what does it look
like? Kind of, yeah. It is kind of lumpy. When you look at it, it takes a leap of faith to some extent, because you look at it and you're like, is this going to turn into bread?
And that's when you take it out of the oven?
No.
When you put it in.
When you put it in, you're like, what is this? I mean, maybe a flatbread? No. Just trust the process, trust the recipe, and you will get a wonderful bread when it's all said and done. It needs to be said that the bread doesn't spend its entire time in an enclosed space. 30 minutes is spent with the top on, and then for the last 15 or 20 minutes of that cooking period, so we're talking about a total baking of about 45 minutes, the last 15 to 20 minutes is with the cover off, and that's what helps develop that sort of dark brown, wonderful color that we love with our bread.
Now, I could be completely misreading you, Noah, but you seem very enthusiastic about this bread.
Very.
Does it taste good?
It tastes amazing. It tastes amazing. It's chewy. It's got lots of big holes in it, which I like, which I value in a bread.
Yeah.
And it's got a wonderful crust.
And it looks good, too.
And it looks, I mean, it looks like anything you would get at a bakery, to be honest. I mean, it comes very close. And actually, when you take it out of the oven, don't do what I think we're probably all tempted to do, which is to just cut it open and eat it. No, no, no. Wait. Have some patience and wait an hour and let that bread cool. And that will really help you enjoy it to the maximum.
I'm not making a lot of bread in my house, but is this a whole lot easier than if you were to make a typical loaf of bread?
It is a lot easier because there aren't many ingredients, 4 or 5 ingredients max, nothing exotic, and really you're just letting time do all the work. So instead of the technique behind kneading, you know, so you don't have to know anything about kneading. All you have to do is throw 19 hours at this dough. And what comes out is a wonderful piece or a wonderful loaf of bread.
So the 19-hour thing, I mean, does that mean that it's sort of fermenting? Or
it is. It's exactly what's happening. Okay. That's exactly what's happening. The yeast is interacting with the flour, and it's creating that bread. And, you know, 19 hours, if you actually think about it, is kind of a convenient time because you can make this bread in 5 minutes, then go to sleep. Heck, you could go to sleep and then go to work and then come home and the bread will be waiting.
It practically bakes itself.
Begging to be baked.
Well, thanks for joining us, Noah. We appreciate that.
It was good to be here.
Noah is one of our in-house foodies at Wisconsin Public Radio.